welcome to this post-election edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we've got a packed lineup today covering everything from the key results and issues here in North Dakota to a look at the bigger picture. It was a historic night across the country, and we're breaking it all down for you. We're excited to kick off today's show with Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. We'll welcome him back to Main Street. He's a professor of history and the Loman Walton Endowed Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies at Dickinson State University. He'll be joining us to analyze the presidential race and what that may mean for the future. Later on, Dave Thompson and I will dive into the local races, talking about what stood out and where North Dakota's political landscape is headed. And don't worry, we've got comfort food covered too. Rick Yan will join us for another edition of Prairie Plates. He'll share his thoughts on the perfect post-election bites. So whether you're celebrating or reflecting, settle in today. Let's get it started. Dr. Cullinane, welcome back to Main Street.
Yeah, great to be back on a historic night.
It's a historic moment in our history of our country, that's for sure. How unprecedented is it for America to re-elect a president who lost, fell from power, and now came back? I can think of Grover Cleveland. That's the one that comes to mind.
That's the only one that exists. So that's great. That's a great trivia question. Grover Cleveland won in 1884, the first one. He lost the second election to Benjamin Harrison and then won in the third election. Interestingly, unlike Donald Trump, Grover Cleveland won the popular vote in all three contests. So Donald Trump had only done that once, most recently this previous night.
Surprises. What surprised you last night as you were watching this evolve?
Well, I think the thing that really struck me was when North Carolina was called, and we knew that North Carolina and Georgia were going to report their returns early. They had hastened the process of reporting, so we knew that that was going to come fairly quick. Although, of course, we thought maybe with Georgia it might go on longer because it did last time around. But North Carolina reported it was a 3% margin, I think, when they reported. And at that stage, I think there was already a lot of worry in the Harris camp. It turns out that they had been talking about the concerns about early voting and the low turnout and low mail-in votes in some states. And really, this was a sweep across the board for Donald Trump. So that early worry was well-founded.
When you look at how this race evolved, that Vice President Harris did not have to go through the primary process, in the end, was that impactful for the Democrats in your view?
Oh, absolutely. But I think what's more important is that Joe Biden didn't have to go through the primary process. The party was so weakened because of Biden. And I'm not going to put all the blame at Harris's feet. I mean, I don't think she was a compelling and charismatic candidate, just like I don't think Hillary Clinton was a compelling and charismatic candidate. But Joe Biden really had set up the Democratic Party for failure here because he left Harris only, 72 or 82 days for her to campaign from start to finish. I mean, she barely introduced herself to the American people. Donald Trump had been campaigning for 2 years. So I think the Democratic Party had a lot to think about in terms of process and primarying. Same problem with Hillary in 2016. She wasn't primaried, not really. And as a result, she was a really, unsatisfactory candidate.
What resonated with voters across our country from Donald Trump?
That is a great question. I think there's a sort of a baseline issue around taxes that remained important. So Trump's idea about not taxing tips for the people that wait tables or serve your drinks, that was one. But not taxing overtime was another big one, and getting rid of income tax overall. I mean, Americans kind of universally hate income tax, so that was a big one. I think his ideas were just bigger and more imaginative than what the Democrats had offered, whether it was Biden or Harris. The Democrats weren't anywhere near as imaginative. And the one issue that stood out to me that the Democrats tried to capitalize on most was abortion. And it turns out abortion is not a national issue. You had states like Missouri, Arizona, Nevada, who had it on as a ballot initiative. Those states voted for Trump, voted for Republican senators, and then voted to make abortion enshrined in their state laws. So that to me was a remarkable turnout that the Democrats, I don't think anyone saw that coming.
What role, if any, do you think the assassination attempts played in electing Donald Trump?
Zero. I think historically they've had no impact. When Teddy Roosevelt got shot in October 1912, it had no impact. I think other presidents have been shot at or you know, even, of course, assassinated. But those assassination attempts have very little bearing on this election, whether it's the one in New Jersey or the one in Pennsylvania. They happen. They cause shock and frustration, I think, because I think the American people, whether you're right or left, you don't support political violence. But what I would say is I don't think it had any real difference in the actual poll results. People decided this election, believe it or not, based on policy and character. And Donald Trump got a resounding victory for those two things. And although it makes a great soundbite, you know, Donald Trump saying that, you know, God spared him for some purpose. In reality, I don't think that had any bearing on most voters' minds.
If you had to tell me the top issue on Republican voters' minds yesterday was the economy, the border, something else, how would you respond?
It wasn't the border. I mean, the border was there. Immigration was there. It was important. It was something that people were talking about. But it is, at the end of the day, it's people's back pockets and purses and the money that's in them. And people felt more confident that Donald Trump was going to deliver more for the American people in a material sense. I mean, you know, the last 4 years have been traumatic for most Americans that are trying to just do their weekly shopping. And that continued to resonate. And the Democrats barely addressed that. I mean, Kamala Harris kept on saying that she wouldn't change anything about Joe Biden's policies. I mean, that was like a lead balloon for the voters. Whereas Trump, I don't think I can remember a presidential candidate that has been so inventive. I mean, arguably, you know, not realistic. I mean, I don't think a lot of what Trump is saying in his economic policies is entirely realistic. But whether it's real or not, it was an imaginative plan for the American people to get the pressures of inflation off of them.
The impact of gender on this election. There was a lot of pre-election hoopla about who was going to chase that younger male vote.
Absolutely. I think the younger male vote is the working male vote. I mean, whether you're educated or, you know, college educated or not college educated, you know, you're like, say, for example, if you're an educated college graduate who has a lot of money in cryptocurrency, you were voting for Donald Trump because Donald Trump was talking about, you know, boosting, you know, cryptocurrency. If you're a young tech bro, you're definitely educated and you're getting paid probably a lot of money, six figures for sure. Your tax bill is going to be less with Donald Trump. You probably voted with him. And if you're a young, not college educated person, let's say you're working as a tradesperson somewhere, you know, Donald Trump is saying that your overtime isn't going to be taxed. All of these things were speaking to Americans' wallets, you know, and I think for that reason he won. I mean, it's pretty plain and simple. I mean, actually, you know, democracy wasn't on the ballot. People were, you know, were talking about democracy, but it wasn't something that stopped people from voting for Donald Trump. And a lot of the other issues that Democrats tried to sort of seize on, which, you know, was character about Trump's character or about abortion, they just fell so flat.
January 6th did not impact the race. Would you agree with that statement?
No, I think it does affect the race. I think the thing is that people that are Republicans that would have swapped over to Harris, you know, the sort of the Liz Cheney element in the party, it matters to them. And I think it matters to a lot of Democrats, and that won't go away. Remember, Donald Trump has a base of about 45% of the country. What this election proved is that the Democrats have a base of about 45% of the country as well. We're talking about, you know, maybe 10% in the middle are independents or people that are, you know, not yet swayed. I mean, basically, that was in the last month of the campaign, 10% moved towards Donald Trump or maybe a little bit less, maybe 5 to 10%. But it's a small group of people. Those people were not swayed by January 6th. There is still a group of Americans that are disgusted and outraged by what happened that day in our Capitol. And I don't think that's ever going to change. There's also, of course, a group that thinks that was, a sort of a moment for freedom and a moment for liberation and not an insurrection at all. So we're still divided, Craig, and that's the bottom line here.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. We are enjoying our conversation with presidential historian Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane. He teaches at Dickinson State University. Dr. Cullinane, isolationism and global impact. We are retreating, I should say, from international conflicts, it seems to me, under a Trump administration to come.
Well, I think if you're a soldier on the front lines in Ukraine, this is probably a pretty bleak day, because Donald Trump has not indicated that he will support the freedom struggle in Ukraine. If you are a Palestinian or of Middle Eastern Arab or Muslim descent, this is probably not a great day, because Trump has indicated that he is full support for Benjamin Netanyahu. I don't think the United States is retreating from the world stage, however. I just think that the priorities for the United States are going to change. I don't think Europe is going to sit quite as comfortably tonight. European nations, particularly defense ministers in Europe, you know, where they're being told they need to pay more for NATO. Donald Trump is certainly going to force that matter. So it's going to be difficult for NATO. I don't think, though, however, what Trump is saying is that the U.S. is not the world leader anymore. He's just saying that he plans on doing it differently. And I don't know how successful that's going to be. I mean, personally, I do feel like America has played and should play a role in world affairs. As I say, if you're a soldier in Ukraine, you're probably feeling pretty isolated tonight.
You spend a lot of time in Europe. In fact, you're in Europe as we visit now. What is the European perspective on the outcome of this election?
That's a great question. Well, look, I'll be honest with you. Most people here were shocked this morning, I think. There's going to be an election in Ireland in a couple of weeks, and I think there'll be elections throughout Europe over the next year. Ultimately, the values, I think, in Europe are different than the values in the United States. Even the most conservative states in Europe are still far, far from Donald Trump. I mean, perhaps the exception is Viktor Orban in Hungary. But, you know, the far right does have pockets of popularity, whether it's the Alternative for Germany or the National Front National in France. But these groups haven't yet come to power. They may do. I mean, Trump's popularity might very well give a boost to some of these groups. And a lot of the issues are the same. Taxation, you know, the role that these countries play in global affairs, and most importantly, perhaps immigration. So it's not, Europe isn't immune to the same sort of possibilities of political change that's happening in the United States. It's just that the values do tend to be a little bit more left-leaning.
Did our country learn something of itself yesterday?
I think so. I think the country learned that that they're comfortable with someone like Donald Trump becoming president, despite all of the transgressions that we know, whether it's, you know, felony convictions, whether it's January 6th, whether it's, you know, all of the sexual accusations of assault and whatnot. That can be forgiven in the eyes of the American voter. And what's astonishing about 2024 is that this is across the board, right? My home state of New Jersey voted for Joe Biden by a margin of 15%. Last night, they voted for Kamala Harris by a margin of 4%. I mean, New Jersey is a pretty deep blue state. So even people in New Jersey are thinking that Donald Trump can be forgiven for his sins. So I think it's a big night monumentally. It means that it's Donald Trump's America now, as the New York Times has on its headline for tomorrow. And I think that is a big change. That's definitely something that is not like previous election cycles that we've seen before.
Anyone in history have a lot of baggage yet survived it in the same way that Trump has in this election?
I mean, interestingly, Grover Cleveland did have a lot of baggage. Talking about non-consecutive presidents, Cleveland had a child out of wedlock, and that came to, you know, public disrepute when he ran for the first time for president. But there is no president that has been impeached and that has run again. That's never happened. I mean, that's pretty unusual. Of course, Trump was impeached twice, so doubly unusual. And of course, there's never been a convicted felon who's run for president successfully. So there are some minor examples, like, you know, Eugene V. Debs ran for president while he was in jail. But that's, I mean, again, he was an outlier politically. Donald Trump is one. So Donald Trump is, you know, he's kind of beat the rap, right? I mean, he's, you know, and that's the amazing thing about democracy, is that, you know, the people have an opportunity to decide whether this person is fit to rule. And overwhelmingly, the American public has decided that Trump is.
What do Europeans think of the Electoral College
Oh, well, that's confusing for most Americans. So let's not get the Europeans wrapped up in that. I mean, they think it's kind of crazy, of course, that you can win the total number of votes and then still. But there are funny electoral setups in Europe as well. I mean, take the United Kingdom, for example. They have a parliamentary system whereby you don't elect the prime minister directly. They're elected in a constituency, and then the party elects the leader. So, you know, that's quite different from the United States. I think the bottom line about the Electoral College this time is that it reflected the popular vote, which wasn't the case in the last election for Donald Trump. Or sorry, I should say the 2016 election for Donald Trump. He didn't win the popular vote, but did win the Electoral College. And that always requires a lot more explaining.
When you looked at swing states that were in play last night, which swing state really surprised you in how they turned for the former president and now president-elect?
I think Michigan is probably the most surprising one. Gretchen Whitmer is a really popular governor in that state. She had, I suppose, set our expectations that Michigan was going to be a great success. But also the Republican Party in Michigan had a major meltdown internally. Like they had huge squabbling going on. They seemed really disorganized. That was a surprise. The vote in Pennsylvania, the other surprise is that I think Elon Musk is going to get a lot of credit for the field campaign in Pennsylvania. He invested a lot of money and a very novel way of turning out the vote. I don't think it worked, but I think because they won Pennsylvania, the Republicans, they're going to say, oh, that was down to Elon Musk. That could be to their own, you know, their own detriment, I think, because if they run with that same sort of field campaign in future elections, I don't think they'll win. What this election showed us was that the field getting out the vote, the field campaign, matters less than the overall message, right? Donald Trump's message resonated beyond any failings that were going on a sort of local level with the field campaign.
What's your view of polls today, the day after the election?
Well, they got it wrong again, right? I mean, the polls for three cycles in a row have downplayed the likelihood of a Trump victory. They downplayed it in 2016. They gave Joe Biden huge margins in 2020, said that he was going to walk away with the election. And of course, it was so close that it took about 4 or 5 days for the votes to be sorted out. And this time around, they had it neck and neck to the very end. In fact, the New York Times had Kamala Harris ahead by 1 point in the final aggregate poll. So again, the polls underestimated Trump's popularity with the electorate. And that's been an ongoing story. If anyone is thinking about running for office, I would suggest a study of Donald Trump, because he has bucked the trends and surpassed everyone's expectations in just about every election.
We've heard the argument today, character no longer matters in American politics. How does that resonate?
I think it does matter. I don't think that it is gone entirely, or at least I would hope so. But what I would say is that voters have been excited about Donald Trump's policies, less than his persona, right? I mean, most people have said that they've either held their nose and voted for Donald Trump, or people have said that, you know, he's been more inventive. So I don't think character is gone. But I do think that the Democratic Party needs to look at itself and say, have they excited their base? Have they excited the American people? And the answer has got to be a no on that front. And Donald Trump has done that.
What should we keep our eyes open for between now and Inauguration Day?
Well, interesting you should say that. I'm actually writing an op-ed at the moment about Elon Musk and a possible efficiency commission, because I think that if we look at the Project 2025, which is the blueprint for, I mean, Donald Trump will say that he's not affiliated with Project 2025, but this is a Heritage Foundation blueprint for how to reorganize the executive structures with the government. And I think Elon Musk might play a big role in that. So keep an eye out on Elon Musk entering the political sphere over the next couple of months. I think we're going to see people like Governor Burgum get a place in the cabinet. I think, you know, he is certainly earned a place in the cabinet, given his ongoing surrogacy work for Trump. And I think other people that you saw at the rally, or I should say the sort of victory speech, Vikram Ramaswamy was there, Robert Kennedy was there, and of course, He was referenced explicitly by Donald Trump as someone who's going to make America healthy again. So I think these are characters that we're going to see in the next administration. And I think you can expect to see, well, I would encourage everyone to read the Project 2025 report, because I think that is a really important one for the next few months.
It's way, way, way too early to ask you this question, but of course I'm going to ask it to you anyway. What Democrats should we pay attention to for 2028? What Republicans should we pay attention to for 2028?
Well, you know what, Craig, that's not a bad question, because Donald Trump is the only president that I could think of that actually comes into office as a lame duck. So that's something to think about, too. He can't run again in 2028. And that means that the Republicans will be putting forward another candidate. And I don't know who that will be. I think that J.D. Vance has proven to be somewhat uninspiring as a candidate. But there are other people in the Republican Party that certainly want that job, whether it's Ron DeSantis or some of the people that have run previously against Donald Trump, like Nikki Haley. Or there could be some new people as well that emerge from this next administration. On the Democratic side, I mean, your guess isn't as good as mine. People like Pete Buttigieg have been popular and have gone over to the Republican networks like Fox and have tried their very best to convince Republicans of the merits of the Democratic platform. But there are not a lot of people on the Democratic side that have that same exciting or sort of inspirational policy bent, and certainly nothing like Donald Trump. So it's hard to see who they're going to have coming up on the benches.
Dr. Michael Patrick Cullinane, he is our presidential historian that we go to from time to time here on Main Street. He teaches at Dickinson State University in the School of Education, where he is a professor of history and the Loman Walton Endowed Chair of Theodore Roosevelt Studies. Dr. Cullinane, it's always a pleasure.
Greg, thanks so much for having me again. So much fun.
Coming up, our news director, Dave Thompson, and I will review North Dakota races and measures. Dr. Rick Becker will reflect on the defeat of the property tax measure. That's Measure 4. And Rick Yon will share his favorite, I didn't know there was such a type of food here, post-election comfort foods. We'll learn what that's all about. That's coming up on Main Street right after this. Welcome back to this Election Day Plus One edition of Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director, joins me to rehash, I guess, Dave, results from last night's election, especially those issues that were important to us here in North Dakota. Dave, first of all, the way I look at this, for North Dakota's perspective, was the election of no surprises. Do you agree with that?
I completely agree with that. The only surprise to me was that some of the measures were a little closer than I thought. Others were more far apart than I thought. But basically, what happened is that I had kind of thought these were the way the measures are going to be.
Let's run down the list of measures. Measure 1 passed resoundingly with 84.5% of the folks voting for. This was just a cleanup measure, Dave.
It was a cleanup measure, yeah. But there were about 15% of the voters who voted no. You have contrarians, I know. Contrarians, that happens once in a while, but I was a little surprised that 15% of the vote was no.
Dave, Measure 2 would have imposed new requirements on ballot initiatives. This was rejected, but not by a lot.
Not by a lot. This was a little closer than I thought it was going to be. I thought the voters were going to really reject this because there was no a campaign to favor this. But, you know, asking people to vote twice on an initiated constitutional measure, didn't set well with a lot of people that I talked to. 56% said no, but 44% said yes, which I thought was kind of interesting. We know what happened with that is that they don't like these out-of-state people coming in and putting things in the Constitution. I know there's some backlash from legislators on that. There's some backlash from some of the voting public as well.
And I think that proved itself in the results of this initiative. Dave, Measure 3 will limit now spending from the state oil and gas fund, for lack of better description. There are other ways to describe it. And that passed by 2%.
By 2%. Now, I found this extremely interesting that this went back and forth all night. And then finally, we had 52% saying yes. What it does is put more, you know, kind of guardrails on spending the principal of the legacy fund, and also said you can only do 5% per year or 5% for biennium. And you have to get a two-thirds vote of both houses to, in order to do that. So there are quite a few guardrails, but the 5% I think was probably a little bit, maybe a little too restrictive for some people, and that's probably why it was that close.
And that brought it down from being able to spend up to 15%, Dave, if I recall. Measure 4, and we'll hear in a little bit from Dr. Rick Becker about this. He was a proponent of Measure 4. Failed, and it failed resoundingly. I thought this might be a little closer. 63.5% of North Dakotans voted no.
And 36.5% voted yes. I honestly think that, you know, the vote coalition, you know, the Keep It Local coalition, actually did a lot of good advertising on this. And the one advertising, in my opinion, and I'm giving you my opinion, that I thought was extremely effective was the, where are you going to get the money? And then you hear crickets, or you see that, you know, things keep going down a hole. I think that resounded with some voters. Yeah, maybe we ought to do this, but where are you going to get the money? So that's a good question.
And the last measure that was on the ballot, Dave, Measure 5, would have legalized recreational marijuana in the state of North Dakota. It failed, but it was closer this time.
52.5% said no. 47.5% said yes. Now, that was really interesting that I kind of thought it was going to fail, but it was really, really close to passing. So the people who are saying, yes, this is a way to avoid becoming another Colorado. You had a lot of law enforcement and medical people who were against it.
I don't think there's any question this will appear on the ballot again sooner or later. All right, let's look at the political races. Dave, the Republicans swept the North Dakota ticket, started with Kelly Armstrong. He fared very well, getting 68.3% of the vote. He'll be North Dakota's next governor.
Right, and I think Kelly is an interesting personality. He's engaging when you talk to him one-on-one. And of course, he's a Western North Dakota guy, and he had an Eastern North Dakota lieutenant governor with him. That kind of helped too. Merrill Pepcorn, you know, he's getting to be, but he probably didn't have the time or money to, you know, get to every corner of the state and become more well-known. He did okay, but Democrats are probably going to regroup and see what's going to happen from now.
And of course, independent Michael Coachman trailed with 5.6% of the vote. The big winner of the night was Julie Fedorchuk. She gained 248,000 votes, the largest vote getter in the evening. That's almost 70% in her race for the U.S. House.
Absolutely. And she also sets a new standard in North Dakota. She becomes the first woman elected to the U.S. House.
Kevin Cramer, he also polled well. Katrina Christensen did get to every corner of North Dakota, but yet just gained just about a third of the vote. Kevin Cramer, 66.5% of the votes tallied.
Yeah, and I think we're seeing the red wave in North Dakota is real. That's a real thing. And Katrina had some pretty good ads. You know, even Republicans I've talked to said she did have some pretty good ads, but they stuck with Cramer because he's been there. Second term is going to be serving in the Senate, served in the U.S. House before. So, you know, he does have a lot of name recognition and a lot of popularity among North Dakotans.
Kirsten Baszler, she retains her seat for North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction.
Now, I watched that all night and I thought, this is going to be kind of close. It was close in a way, but, you know, Jason Heitkamp didn't have a lot of money to run anything, any kind of campaigns, but maybe there's something else that's kind of driving the anti-DPI sentiment right now. I think this is going to be something that's going to be worth watching over the next year or two.
So, Dave, what comes out of the election now as we kind of look a little bit forward when the legislature meets next year? The governor, Governor Burgum, will still submit a budget. The new legislature will have a chance to pick it apart. Were there any mandates coming out of this election, Dave, that you noticed? And the one that's on top of my mind is property taxes.
And when talking to the governor-elect, he said it is top of his mind to priority number one, property taxes. We have to do something to reform property taxes. And just giving, you know, property tax rebates is probably not going to do it. So he realizes that there is angst and there's some unrest about property taxes in North Dakota because they keep going up.
Dave, what did you learn from this election?
I learned that, in a way, you have to say that the Democrats, you know, they've tried, but there might be something that I heard from one of the, from Josh Beauchesne at one of the conventions. He said, what we need to do as Democrats is concentrate on the bread and butter, the kitchen table issues, and stop being national. And I think they may have to look at that a little bit more carefully and talk more about bread and butter issues.
Dave Thompson joins us periodically when we have issues to talk about here on Main Street. He'll be back with me tomorrow to review this week's news. Dave, always great to hear your voice.
Dr. Rick Becker, he was a proponent of Measure 4 that would have ceased having property taxes against the assessed value of property here in North Dakota. And he joins us today. Dr. Becker, welcome back to Main Street.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What didn't resonate with voters, Dr. Becker, in your mind relative to Measure 4?
Well, I don't think it's what didn't resonate with voters. It's what did. And the opposition to Measure 4 had a tremendous amount of fundraising. They were able to outspend us 20-1, and those are pretty much insurmountable odds. So they were able to get their message out. What resonated with voters was their message, which was based in fear of losing funding, fear of having schools closed, fear of having to lay off teachers and firemen and policemen. And unfortunately, those fears are unfounded, but that's what the voters, by and large, heard because of the dramatic difference in funding and capability of getting message out. Many people did not hear our message or at least enough to know that we can counter those other concerns of fear. And we see that somewhat, I think, typically we would have expected rural areas to be our strongest area of support. Rural areas more likely to be opposed to paying taxes on property, and yet we found rural areas were our weakest area. And that message of fear of closing schools and closing small towns, I think that's what really got them out and voting no.
What does this mean for the future of property taxes then in North Dakota in your eyes?
Well, I hope that this will be impetus for the legislature when they convene in January to really take up true reform, true property tax relief. And I think they can do this in many ways. And there is, I believe, there are discussions taking place right now on them being able to do that. So I hope they're serious about it. I hope they take over K-12 education funding and take over that last 20% that property taxes are paying for. And I hope that they do away with valuations and mill levies, which are not a good or fair way to tax the people of North Dakota.
Is that the silver lining of Measure 4 in your eyes, Dr. Becker, that it now has brought this more to the forefront, so to speak?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that's the silver lining. I'm always one just to believe in going out and doing and just trying to make things happen and fighting for what you believe in. And the ripple effect of what may come from that may be significant. It may not. But the point is that you try.
Do you see this being tried again, Dr. Becker?
Well, I think if the legislature doesn't provide significant relief and reform in this next session, then certainly you'll see it again. And so it's in their hands. It's up to the legislature on whether we bring another ballot measure for eliminating property tax in 2 years.
Dr. Rick Becker, he's a proponent of Measure 4 that would have eliminated property taxes against the assessed valuation of property. It was defeated by about a 63% no vote. Dr. Becker, thank you so much for joining us again on Main Street.
Thank you. Have a good day.
I like bagels.
Have some salad. All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Apple sauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music that always makes me think of food and our weekly edition of Prairie Plates with Rick Gion. Rick, the election is here, I think, and now it is over with. But we're still going to kind of talk about the election today in one way or another. How are you, Rick? And welcome back to Main Street.
I'm doing very well, Craig. How are you?
Doing very good. Rick, well, as we know, the election was held yesterday. But regardless of your political party, you still have to have food for this post-election anxiety we're all feeling. Isn't that right, Rick?
Yes, I think this election caused anxiety for most folks, and it's time to get into some comfort food and relax a little bit. I think cooking and eating can be quite therapeutic and a way to kind of get the let out, I guess. So yes, let's talk a little bit about comfort food and then where to get comfort food. All around the region, I've listed a fair amount of restaurants here. I do a lot of eating of comfort foods. So,
yeah. So the first topic that you mentioned is pretty much one of my favorites, but maybe not for the reason that you think. And it's brunch. Well, if we're eating brunch, Rick, that means we got to sleep in a little bit. We didn't have to get up so early to get to work or get to somewhere. We could kind of take the day easy and start off with a great brunch.
And this weekend, I'll be sleeping in a little bit. I can guarantee you that. But yes, brunch, I think brunching is a very, it's a very good pastime for people. And I enjoy a larger brunch, egg bakes, frittatas, bacon, sausage, fruit. I like fresh cut fruit. And then a variety of pastries. If you're somewhere that likes to make pastries, that's kind of nice. But if you're at home, it's just kind of fun to make a brunch-lunch kind of combo. I really like an egg bake or frittata with a little bit of a salad, fresh greens, that sort of thing. But brunch can be a very good meal, that's for sure.
We had a neighbor in Cheyenne, and I didn't get the hang of this until I watched it in action. He had his Traeger grill outside. He had a beautiful landscape deck, but he also then had his Blackstone. And when I first saw that, it was October, November, it was wintertime, and I thought, who needs a griddle outside? And then I saw on Saturdays and Sundays how they used it. It was exactly for that reason. Family and friends came over for brunch, and it was just a great way to gather and visit and kind of start a lazy weekend day.
That Blackstone can be a great tool. And yes, for brunch, scrambled eggs, over easy eggs, pancakes, it's great because you can knock out like 12 pancakes at a time.
Right there, right on time. And then, but what he did was, and it wasn't fair, he threw the bacon on there and the whole neighborhood just smelled so good. You knew it was time and they had the mimosas flowing over there all the time and it was just really a lot of fun.
That is a lot of fun. And when that happens, it's kind of like the cartoons when the characters kind of lift up off the air and follow the scent.
That was me. That was us. Oh my goodness. Almost every Saturday and Sunday. But yeah, there's lots of great, great ways to enjoy brunch, but then there's also some other ways to enjoy comfort food in the area, Rick, for sure.
Yeah, and there's just a variety of things that come to mind, mostly like Swedish meatballs, pot roast, other braised roasted meats. I really like hot beef sandwiches, hot turkey sandwiches, soups and stews, and those can be very good on the vegetarian end with curries and lentil soups, lentil stews, that sort of thing. So those can be a lot of fun to make at home. And then for desserts, pie, bars, cookies. I've been eating a lot of ice cream lately. I've been going to the store late at night because I just need it, I guess, and sure, buying pints of Ben and Jerry's because it's on sale. But I just, yeah, I've been needing it lately just because I've been high anxiety, I guess, you know?
You know, when you threw this topic my way for us to talk about on Prairie Plates, and I'm being joined here by Rick Guillon. He comes to us on Main Street every Wednesday for another edition of Prairie Plates. Comfort food for me, Rick, I thought about shepherd's pie. When we were kids, I remember it, so it has that good, you know, the great memory, the nostalgia, if you will. But still today, boy, it just tastes too good.
Yeah, there's something about a good shepherd's pie that really hits, and it's just kind of a warming, comforting, all-in-one meal. And I think, they just hit the right notes, all the right notes there. It's not as popular around here as maybe some of these other things, such as Swedish meatballs. I mean, if I put a picture of a hot beef sandwich on my Fargo Moorhead Eats Facebook group, it gets like 300 or 400 likes. But I'll try that with a shepherd's pie and see what happens. But yeah, it is an all-in-one comfort food that really hits the spot.
Well, if you can share with me maybe a little bit later where the best shepherd's pie is in town, I'll be a partaker of that for sure. I can promise you that.
I would try Blarney Stone. Well, let's just get at it right
there.
Yes.
Well, we had takeout from Blarney Stone just on Saturday, and I didn't even think about looking for shepherd's pie on the menu. I had a Cuban sandwich with some Nephila soup, which was really, really good. But I need to look more than just hanging out with the old go-tos. Guaranteed I will have shepherd's pie next time we eat at the Blarney Stone.
They really have a lot of good items there and a lot of comfort food. So I usually get like fish and chips, or there's some curry stew dishes. There's just a variety of things. Their corned beef is fantastic. But back to the comfort food restaurants around the region, we can talk a little bit about, well, I listed quite a few of these, but Jack's restaurant in Dickinson has good borscht and Nephila soups. They're really known for their borscht. And they just have a good variety of comfort foods, well known in that southwestern part of the state. So if you're in Dickinson, check out Jack's restaurant. Ohm's in Mandan is another good one for some Germans from Russia items. They do have cheese buttons, things like that, Nephila soup, that sort of thing. And that's a really well-known place for a lot of comfort foods. The other one in that area I really enjoy is Little Cottage by the Big Boy in Bismarck. And it's just this little place, and it fills up fast, especially Saturday mornings. And they just do a really good job of omelets and breakfasts and brunches, and then just other comfort foods.
Just the name of the place sounds really good to me, Rick. The Little Cottage. Let's go there.
Yes. Yes. And then moving a little further east in East Grand Forks, I follow Bernie's on social media quite a bit, and I've been up there quite a few times, and it just is a really good comfort, elevated comfort food location. Molly A just does a really, really nice job with things. So that's definitely a must try. I think it's just kind of more of a tourist attraction too. So yeah, definitely worth a try. The Shack in North Fargo is one of those places that's really iconic in the state of North Dakota. They just win numerous media best of breakfast awards year after year after year after year. So it's that's definitely a must try. It's way up in North Fargo on 32nd Avenue and Broadway. One of my favorites is the Sons of Norway in downtown Fargo. They just make consistently good comfort food Monday through Friday. It's just really, really good. They sometimes have a brunch on Sundays. I was there on Sunday, as a matter of fact, and that was quite good if you like carbs. And then over in West Fargo is Diener's Diner. And in Moorhead, I really enjoy the Moorhead Fry and Pan. But I think, too, if you're around a truck stop.
I was surprised that truck stops were on your list, but here we go. You betcha.
Yes. I do enjoy popping into a truck stop every once in a while. Petro here in Fargo, Dolly Down's quite good. The Tower City Cafe is really iconic and popular in North Dakota.
We found that Tower City Cafe, Rick, and I agree with you. I enjoy stopping there.
Yeah, a lot of people do, and they have a lot of sweet treats, cookies, pies, pastries, that sort of thing, and it's famous, well, especially in the eastern part of the state for comfort food. So, and then the other truck stop I found is in Rothsay, Minnesota. If you're on I-94, it's about halfway between Fargo and Fergus Falls. But that's kind of an interesting spot, too. So, yeah, truck stops can be a very fulfilling opportunity to take up. But and then also local community cafes. I would, you know, everyone has their favorite community cafe, and that's really great. And a lot of communities have bragging rights, and that's fun to listen to and hear people argue about, actually. I kind of get a kick out of that. But two of my favorites are, well, the Pheasant in Mott, North Dakota is very iconic, especially for pheasant hunters during this season. And then the Cullum Uptown Cafe does a really nice job. And there are many, many others in most smaller and medium-sized communities in North Dakota that are definitely worth a stop. So anyway, that's a lot of comfort food for a Wednesday here.
A sharply divided electorate made choices yesterday, Rick.
and you brought us together today with some good food right here on Prairie Plates. Kudos to you, Rick. Thanks for joining us on this edition of Prairie Plates. We'll look forward for more.
Sounds good, Craig.
Looking to spice up your Sunday afternoon? Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra presents Joie de Vivre on November 17th at 3 p.m. at Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church in Bismarck. This program features a delightful mix of music for piano, flute, and strings by Shostakovich, Gubert, and Mozart, featuring performances by the music faculty from University of Mary, Bismarck State College, and Minot State University. Tickets are available at the door.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 6th. On this date, in 1941, poultry were in the news in various ways. During World War II, poultry played a crucial role in the Food for Freedom program, which aimed to boost food production with the slogan, "Food will win the war." In 1942, farmers were tasked with producing a minimum of 4 billion dozen eggs, an 18% increase from the previous year. To meet this higher demand, farmers needed to increase egg production from their flocks rather than expanding their flock sizes. This led to a push for better quality feed and healthier chickens. Ads for products like Aco Mineral Compound promised to improve egg production, while Rota Caps were marketed to address worms that affected profits. Chicken feeds were bringing people together. The Noonan Methodist Woman's Society of Christian Service hosted a fancy work sale and supper, offering a meal with fried chicken, mashed potatoes, gravy, cabbage, bread, and more for just 40 cents. As Thanksgiving approached, communities began their turkey days, although many turkeys were not yet ready due to poor weather earlier in the year. Despite this, the Armor Creameries in Minot advertised, "Turkeys, turkeys," as everyone talked turkey. Joe Schneider of Linton reported losing 25 chickens to theft. Although the thieves didn't clean out his coop, they stole his best birds, leading the Ward County Independent to note, "The chicken stealing season near Linton seems to be on." Similarly, Vernon Lundgren of Tembeck had 3 turkeys stolen. While the thieves were driving away, a neighbor raised the alarm, alerting Lundgren to the theft, but he was too slow to catch them. Fortunately, rather than being caught with the goods, the thieves released the turkeys, which returned to Lundgren the next day. Poultry continued to make headlines, whether through bartering in the Ambrose Herald, educational events in Brampton, or turkey shows in Ellendale. Clearly, these birds were making news across the state. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Cody Goring. I'm Ann Olquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Layla Falded, co-host of Morning Edition, which you can hear weekdays on Prairie Public. At NPR, we believe a journalist's life experience and perspective is an asset to covering a story, not a liability. As an Arab American who reported on the Middle East during the Arab Spring and the emergence of ISIS in Iraq, I was able to frame stories in a way that brought you closer to the people living through them. When you listen to NPR on Prairie Public, whether you're driving to work in Fargo or Bismarck, or you're up early getting ready for a day's work on the farm, you're transported to another part of the world. I hope that makes you feel closer to it. NPR's international reporting is made possible by NPR stations and its members. I hope you'll become one right now at prairiepublic.org. Just open the link that says donate. Thanks.
Donald Trump will be the next president of the United States. As he finalizes plans for his second administration and votes continue to be counted, we'll consider what his victory will mean for the economy, immigration, abortion, and other issues. That's tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We're deeply grateful that you've spent time with us.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with Patrick McCloskey, editor of the Dakota Digital Review. The Review is a publication that explores cyber sciences and their societal, ethical, legal, and cultural impacts, written in a language that can help us all make critical decisions about technology's role in our collective and personal futures. Plus, Madeline will review the movie Conclave. It already has a lot of Oscar buzz. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll be with us.